For those of you that think our intros are a work, where Dazzle will send me an intro, and I'll clearly know what it is, you try telling me with a straight face you know what Blake Sevens is. Dazzle, what's Blake Sevens?
Blake Seven is one of the most awesome TV shows that the BBC ever produced. Forget about Doctor Who being the greatest sci-fi that ever came out of Britain. It's not. It was Blake Seven. This show was absolutely awesome on so many levels. First of all, it had really shoddy sets, costumes, special effects, acting, but the show was great. It was so much fun, and it was played straight. Basically, and in many years, it was really years ahead of its time. And forget the special effects and all that. The actual story was basically a ragbag team or a group of sort of rebel freedom fighters who were basically all pretty much, some of them anti-heroes, basically fighting against this like evil dictatorship, you know, throughout the universe. And it was just a really awesome show. So like lots and lots of sort of shades of grey, you know, and it was just an amazing TV show. Just sort of really, not like sort of gritty in a sort of like, you know, a Blade Runner or a new Battlestar Galactica sense, but just sort of like, you know, some of the storylines just had a real sort of like, you know, questioning the actual, you know, the integrity of characters and stuff like that. And it was a really, really fun show. And it lasted for 4 seasons. And the reason why I sort of have that theme music is I did an article, which is on Half Guarded, which is called basically Everybody Dies. And it's basically a list of my favorite things to do with pop culture, whether it be TV, comics or everything, where all the good guys die at the end. And that's pretty much what happened. And you know, spoiler, it's actually what happened in Blake Seven. It basically everybody in the final episode, all the heroes and everything, were basically all gunned down in a scene that basically lived in absolutely sort of legendary status and infamy among sort of young boys of my age. Because it was basically, you know, you just saw all these characters who you basically sort of got to know, who are just basically sort of like, you know, gunned down in the most tragic circumstances. It's a really great, you know, episode. And there was a character on there. Basically, they started off that the team was basically, there were seven of them and were led by Blake's, hence the name Blake Seven. But there was this character who basically stole the show, and he was called Avon. And he had an actor who were basically, I think the guy's name was Paul Darrow, and he was a real, he was like the anti-hero. He was like the one who was sort of working for his own agenda and actually hated Blake, so he had like a conflict going on there. And he would basically, his acting was, it was just extraordinary. He would basically ham it up so much. It was unbelievable. But you just loved this character. He was like the sort of, you know, the cool one, but also a little bit, basically, if you imagine Han Solo, but rather than sort of turning out to be a rogue with a sense of sort of, you know, what was right and stuff, this guy didn't. This guy basically, you know, went with the anti-hero rules. And like I say, he ended up actually, because the actor who played Blake left after 2 seasons. And so basically, Avon was basically became the leader of the group. And it was for its time, it was just, you know, a great show. You know, put aside all the sort of dodgy special effects and the really dodgy looking laser guns that look like they've been made out of washing up liquid bottles and stuff. It was a great show because it was sort of had that little kitsch to it. But and the fact that every single episode, the planet always seemed to look like a quarry mine or a forest, which was just, you know, it was just a great, you know, really fun TV show. And it's one that sort of has always stuck with the memories of people. But like I said, the final episode is an absolute stormer. It's just the best way to basically finish off a TV show, and basically everyone sort of dies. And there's no, a lot of times you'll basically get a TV show where everyone sort of dies and it's like for a heroic cause. And this sort of, you know, this was like in a certain other film that's out at the moment where everybody dies, but they complete the mission, if you know what I'm saying, nudge, nudge. But this one, there was no like silver lining or anything. Everyone just basically got killed. It was incredible. And as a kid, I actually remember sort of like watching this episode. I knew it was going to be the last the season was ending. But I was just actually in shock that it ended this way, with everyone just sort of gunned down. It was just incredible. Wow. So I would recommend reading my article, especially, you know, because I've got stuff in there. I've got Norse mythology, I've got comics, I've got movies, but the bit that I really wanted to write about was Blake 7. And I've even got the clip of the final showdown, as it was.
Well, there you go. So if you haven't already, go to halfgarden.com and check out Daz's article.
I think all the episodes are sort of available on YouTube as well, which is not the in line with licensing laws, but they all seem to be on there, so it's worth dipping in.
All right, I'll be sure to check those out probably. All right, let's start the show properly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you're listening to a brand new episode of Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. All right, it's been a while since we did a traditional show. On today's show, we have movies to talk about. But, you know, that's part of the course on Tales from the Gout Zone. We're here specifically to talk about Batman movies. Is that correct, Dazza?
Yeah, I thought we'd talk about basically the... Because Batman's really in the news this week, but... Rather than talk about a film which basically is probably not going to be seen for about 3 or 4 years at least, and we've no idea what's actually happening with it, and any sort of speculation we've done is probably going to be sort of, you know, what's the... Basically, I was going to talk about the whole Ben Affleck not being a director thing, and then I just thought, what's the point? None of us really know what's going on behind the scenes. You know, none of us basically know what's going to go down with this film or anything. So I thought, why not actually talk about two films which actually have been made in recent memory?
Although, judging from the fact that I've seen a variant of one of the movies and then I've seen the other film, I wish they had not been made. All right, Dazzle, where do you want to start? Because specifically we're talking about two films here, so I'm going to let you decide which one we talk about first, and then we'll naturally, with the only two movies, we'll naturally transition to the next one.
Well, first up, we'll talk about the Batman versus Superman, the Ultimate Edition. Because
this is the one I haven't seen. Obviously, I've heard people talk about it. They said it does a better job of explaining stuff. But I haven't heard from anybody that's watched the special edition of the movie where it has this extended part and they explain more stuff. Nobody ever attempts to explain that it justifies the movie. It turns it into a good movie. Is this the case, Dazza, with you? Or is it still a bad movie?
It's the case with me, because I basically do think it makes it into a good movie.
Ooh, how about
personally.
That?
Personally, yeah. But then again, I'm always way off in when I'm always against public opinion when I'm talking about these things anyway. So who cares? Why should I change now? I mean, basically, just to put my and obviously it's late news, but I've only just got around to seeing Batman v Superman: The Ultimate Edition, because you had to basically buy it on Blu-ray and everything. So, you know, not really, whereas I'm still on DVD. basically, my feelings on Batman v Superman was that I actually liked the film, but I didn't love it. And I thought that there were lots, even though I enjoyed the film, I thought there were lots and lots of problems with it. When it comes to this special edition, I was basically sort of dubious on how much more it would actually alter the film, because it's basically, there's like about half an hour's extra footage on there. And I'm always dubious about these ultimate editions and special editions, because a lot of the time it's basically footage that is basically... Was basically adds pretty much nothing to the actual film. I mean, it takes something like, for example, Aliens... To take Alien Special Edition, that's a film where when you actually saw the extended footage, none of the scenes actually added anything to the actual film. In fact, in many ways, they took away. They were sort of, you know, they actually tried to, you know, they took away the suspense by sort of showing what had actually happened on the planet before the Marines got there and everything. And all the scenes, all the extra sort of fight scenes, there was nothing in there that was sort of interesting to enthusiasts, but there was nothing in there that made it a better movie. And I think that's right for a lot of these extended films. This one, when I watch this is the film that they should have shown in the cinema. It really is. And from all accounts, it sounds like this is the film that Zack Snyder actually wanted to show. Because there's a story that the first time that they actually showed Batman v Superman, and I'm guessing it's this, what is now the Ultimate Cut, that the execs really, really liked it and they sort of applauded, but they told him that he had to cut basically a lot of footage because basically it was too long. Mm-hmm. And we were sort of worried about getting the, you know, the amount of people, you know, the amount of screenings in a particular day to sort of, you know, maximize their profits, everything. So they told him to basically cut loads out. And it basically, when you actually watch this and compare it to the original, you see what it sort of explains why the sort of the film in the cinema was so disjointed, so seemingly badly edited, where basically a lot of it really didn't make sense. And when you see the stuff put back in there, I personally think it makes it a much, much better movie. And the first thing which is really, really jarring is the opening desert scene, because that scene in the it's a really confusing scene when you watch it in the original, because it's just sort of like almost like just a little prologue. But the thing, but it doesn't really the problem is that little scene was supposed to set up the entire movie. The consequences of everything that was happening was to pay out a lot later. And they actually they didn't just like condense that scene down. They also took out all the consequences that came from that. And because what actually happens in that scene is basically when you watch the Ultimate Edition, you see what was actually going down while they were meeting with this guy, but also you see why people were basically blaming Superman for everything that had happened. And also, and it's a better, sort of more dramatic scene. There's more suspense to it. But also the sort of, you know, but after that, you see, in the original, you see a scene where where one of the survivors is basically giving some testimony out. And then she basically disappears for the rest of the movie. In the Ultimate Edition, that storyline basically sort of pans out along the film. So it has sort of real consequences that basically, and her own storyline sort of, basically sort of, you know, it doesn't actually forget it, and it basically, it keeps the whole sort of Superman, you know, why Superman is sort of, you know, going before this committee, why the sort of, you know, you get a better sense of that. Another thing that you get a better sense of, because that is all part of Lex Luthor's plot, you also see Lex Luthor, how he's basically manipulating Batman and Superman to basically sort of be in conflict with each other. And just little light scenes where it shows you sort of, the fact that Lex orchestrated for Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent to be at that dinner together to sort of, like, you know, sort of, you know, to foster more resentment between them. How he basically had a better plan to bring the two together and what his overall aims were. Also the Holly Hunter character, her storyline when she sort of, you know, there's a lot more conflict between her and Lex. You also get a lot more of Lois Lane's basically investigation into the bullet that she's found, and basically sort of, you know, trying to track down what had actually happened in the desert. There's just so many things in there that sort of like that basically make just more sense as a narrative. You know, Clark Kent, who was basically, you know, the whole sort, I mean, the thing is a lot of sort of Superman what was cut out in this. You see, Superman seems to have been cut out, you know, so much. It's particularly with Clark Kent, when he's sort of like, you know, doing the investigation into the Batman story. In the Ultimate Edition, you actually see him going to war, you know, meeting up with the victims of Batman and stuff, and the families of victims. So that when he actually intercedes with Batman in that scene where he basically sort of like, you know, basically sort of blocks him in the car and everything, In the original film, that just seems to come out of nowhere. Whereas in the Ultimate Edition, it basically it's like a steady build, so that when he does that, you know why he is doing that. He's been driven to do that. He's been driven to basically sort of take a stand. And it also makes some of the scenes which are actually in there better, because that whole scene, you know, there is basically throughout this Superman sort of questioning what his role is in the world, particularly because of the events of what happened in the desert. He's trying to figure out, you know, who he is, you know, what he should actually, you know, do in life. Should he basically sort of, you know, be the you know, do they actually need him to be basically sort of like coming in and saving the day, you know, or is he basically causing more problems? And you see, you know, people's sort of reactions to him changing. And it's just like the scene where on the balcony where he's talking to Lois, that's given more pathos, because you've actually sort of gone on this journey where he's sort of doubting himself and questioning, you know, what he's doing. And just, they're only sort of little scenes and everything, but they basically make it so much more important movie that you sort of, you really get into, you know, why they're doing what they're doing. It's one of these things that I don't think this is going to change anyone's mind about the movie. If you didn't like Batman v Superman for whatever reason, it may sort of explain a few things better, but you're not going to basically sort of come in and think that, wow, that, you know, that I really did enjoy that movie after all. But I think if you liked Batman v Superman, or you were on the fence and thought it were okay, I think this is the version you need to be watching from now on. I never want to watch the old Batman v Superman again. You know, I can't, after seeing this, because it basically, it makes it a lot better movie. And I personally, you know, for me, and I realize I am in a massive minority then, I actually find it, this Ultimate Edition is a really, really enjoyable movie. It's still got a lot of problems. There's still, you know, the stuff with Doomsday never really worked with me. The actual battle at the end, I was fine with. You know, even though I didn't like the CGI, the battle stuff, I was sort of, you know, fiery, because you needed something in there to basically bring the people together. And to be honest, it's kind of, a lot of superhero films do this, where they have to have a sort of a big battle at the end that sort of sometimes takes you out. You know, like the first Iron Man film, I thought the battle between Iron Man and Iron Monger sort of was a really, it just felt out of place with the rest of the movie. Even though I sort of thought the battle thing, the whole, how Doomsday came about and everything, that sort of didn't, you know, I didn't like that whole subplot or anything. It just didn't work for me. And also, obviously, the whole sort of Martha thing, you know, and you know, that sort of still in there and stuff. So you got all those little things. But as a whole, as an actual movie, I found it so much better. And I think it's a shame that this is, I understand why they did it for the length of time, but I think that the scenes that they cut out, a lot of them, they were sort of, you know, vital stuff. It made it a better, more understandable movie. And this is really the film I wish I'd have seen in the cinema. Even if it was 3 hours?
Yeah, I think that would have been a hard sell for a lot of folks. I mean, you're already talking about a superhero film that people were already kind of skeptical going in, and you're asking people to devote 3 hours, especially, you know, they may do things here and there to obviously deter children, but when you're talking about a Batman versus Superman film, obviously you're going to do that with children in mind. So the idea, you're going to have them sit down and watch a 3 hour film. You're going to ask the regular moviegoer to sit down and watch a 3 hour superhero film. That really is asking a lot.
It is. And I understand why they did it, but you know, for just speaking for me, you know, this is the film that I wanted to see. And part of this is Zack Snyder's fault, because he should have basically been able to tell the story in 2.5 hours somehow, because this is the story that he needed to be told. But, you know, I personally, you know, they could have sort of, like, you know, cut things in other places. They could have made some of the Doomsday stuff, they could have made sort of shorter and everything. But personally, you know, this for me is the version that I want to see from now on, because I really do think it makes it a lot better movie. If you didn't like it, I'm not going to sort of twist people's arm to go watch it, because I don't think it's going to change a lot of people's mind on it. I think if you did like the movie beforehand, also to enjoyed it, I think this will basically make you feel, you know, it will basically affirm your sort of, like, you know, your taste in the film, you know, even more.
I'll direct people to the comment section if you want to take the Dazza to task for his recommending of Batman vs. Superman, the Ultimate Edition. No, obviously, I can't vouch for it, Dazza. I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to watch it myself. If I watch it, and man, I'm gonna set the bar kind of low. If it's a better interpretation of the film, then I'll give you credit where credit is due. I'm certainly not gonna set the bar up high as you have and say it's a fairly decent movie now. It's like, okay, I'm kind of expecting, you know, maybe that'll make it really easy for it to meet my expectations if I have it really low. There's been times where I've had films that had really low expectations. I think, namely, the first Ninja Turtles movie, where I had no expectations walking into that film. And that's why I think maybe I liked it, because I had dirt low expectations. And I think that's what I mean, what wound up happening here. But I'll check it out, Dazza. And I'll report back to you pretty soon and let me know. I'll let you know what I think about it.
It's worth pointing out, but it doesn't change the overall, you know, thrust of the story. But what it does is it makes that story. So if you didn't like the story, you probably won't like it, but it makes that story better and more understandable. And I think it is a more coherent movie, you know, and it's a more compelling movie. And I sort of came away from it. Like I said, I like the first one, but this is a film that I sort of like, you know, I really do, you know, really do like.
All right, let's talk our other Batman movie that we have on today's slate. Let's talk, we've obviously talked about it before as far as the news of this is concerned, but let's talk about your formal review of Batman the Killing Joke.
Well, I've said before that one of the things that DC does really, really well is its animated movies. Mm. They've just sort of got a knack of choosing the right stories to sort of turn into animated. They get a really good cast, you know, an actual proper, like, you know, they don't go cheap. They get proper actors to do this, which basically helps for quality. And they basically made some really, really fun and interesting movies. Not this one. I had low expectations, and it kind of sort of went lower than that. The problem is, this is meant to be the Killing Joke. And the problem with the Killing Joke is it is a basically one-issue story. It's a very short story. So they obviously had to extend it. But what they did to extend it was they basically tacked on at the start of it, basically a Batgirl story. Mm-hmm. And it's not even a good Batgirl. It's basically a Batgirl story where a gangster begins stalking her. And so her and Batman are basically sort of working against this gangster who's got a crush on her. And it bears absolutely no link at all to the rest of the Killing Joke. It's basically like just half an hour of the story. My suspicion is that they had a female character in the film, and they didn't want her to basically be in there just to get shot and molested by the Joker. And they basically sort of, because I know there's been sort of there was a lot of sort of controversy when they did that that alternative cover for a Superman Batman book, and it had basically sort of a Joker sort of stood behind a Batgirl, and he sort of like drawing the Joker's face on her, and I know that sort of caused a lot of controversy. So I think we wanted to sort of avoid that, and we thought they would flesh out the character somewhat and give her more to do, so she wasn't just there as basically a damaged damsel in distress. But what they did was basically they sort of took the whole focus away from what should have been a film about Batman and the Joker and their sort of their relationship, to this weird relationship that they have with each other. And it just doesn't, you know, it just doesn't fit in with the Killing Joke. Mm-hmm. And just forgetting all the stupid thing and to where they have them basically having a sort of sex on the, you know, Batman and Batwoman having sex on top of a building, and always like sort of, you know, as if it's, you know, to bring him some sort of emotional attachment of why Batman sort of goes after the Joker. All of this, it's just there for no reason. It just feels like an episode of another Batman TV show that's being tagged onto the Joker thing. And if they wanted to sort of add more thing to it, they should have done more of the Joker. Also to done some sort of like some recap of their rivalry in the past, or just something that was sort of kept it with the core of the movie. I mean, even the stuff with the Killing Joke stuff itself, it just didn't, when I was watching it, it just wasn't really interesting. And it's not that it was basically a pretty much almost a scene for scene reenactment of the actual comic, but then again, so was the Dark Knight two movies that they did, you know, the old Frank Miller classic, and that I loved. I liked seeing that actually be, you know, being performed and being sort of, you know, put together. But this one, I just didn't find it. Just, I don't know if I was taken out of it by that first half hour. Mm-hmm. And then be sort of, you know, but it just, I just felt it was kind of like a complete and utter waste. And I understand, you know, why they did it, because it's one of the most iconic and well remembered comics. But it's one of these things as well that I think the Killing Joke was really, really good for its time, because it was when comics were starting to get a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more adult. And it was good. It was like sort of shocking at the time to see, you know, because you saw the Joker basically going to these sort of like real extremes to play with people's heads, you know, and he was sort of like, you know, trying to basically sort of drive people mad. He was trying to drive Commissioner Gordon, you know, to the brink. He was basically sort of seemed to be trying to get Batman to basically sort of step over the line. You know, but there seemed to be something going on, which was sort of, and it was sort of interesting at the time. But I don't think it's a comic that particularly, even Alan Moore says he doesn't, you know, look back to it as one of his great works. Mm-hmm. But this film, I thought was an opportunity. There was a real opportunity there, and it just wasn't good at all. Even at the end, they felt the need to show that that Batgirl had got over her. She got over disability and had turned it all into a positive, and it showed you were basically becoming Oracle, and it just sort of it just felt like it was trying to leave things. The thing about the Killing Joke is it's supposed to leave you on like a really spooky ending where they're both in the rain sort of laughing. And that sort of shot where it sort of pulls away and you see the puddle. And it just like leaves you with that really unsettling feeling. But you have to question, you know, what is this strange, bizarre relationship they've got with each other? You know, are they both same two sides of the coin? It's supposed to ask questions. And it's supposed to basically sort of like, you know, the whole nature of their feud. It's supposed to make, and it's supposed to be uncomfortable. And then they sort of give it like a little happy ending tagged on. it just the whole thing, you know, this if I'd have done this right, this should have been and this is what probably going to sound like sort of totally alien to all these people complaining about the tone of Batman v Superman. This is one where it should have been really dark and creepy and unsettling and sinister. You know, because that's what the original Killing Joke was. And in this one, it felt like this sort of were doing an animated movie of it, but they basically wanted to sort of like, you know, give you like a happy ending and everything, and sort of like, and just sort of, they seem to be sort of too concerned with, you know, other matters on doing this in the in basically with 21st century sensibilities.
Yeah, a little bit. I'm curious what you thought of the musical number. people have been apologetic about the film. They're like, well, okay, if you can forgive the first 30 minutes, the rest of the film is pretty good of itself, and it has Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill reprising their roles from the Batman animated series as Batman and Joker. And that's fine and all, and I can sort of see past that once you get into the actual film itself. But still, the musical scene, that I think that's maybe a couple of minutes into the film, I thought that was pretty cringeworthy as well.
Yeah. I don't know what we're trying to get do with that, to be honest. To be honest, I'd forgotten about that. But yeah, it was,
Yeah, this is one of these instances of where just like, I don't know what DC was thinking about. It's like, I understand the idea that you want to make The Killing Joke a feature-length film because it's so highly sought of, it's so highly thought of from the comic book readers point of view. Obviously, you mentioned earlier that Alan Moore, you know, even when he was writing it, he didn't think it was that big a deal. It wasn't that much of a story. But since then, the comic book readers have sort of, you know, fostered it and sort of, you know, hoisted upon themselves that it's a really good title, really put in a plateau. And I think it's a good story. I think it's a really good story. It's probably one of and I know he probably wouldn't agree, but I think it's one of Alan Moore's best stories. But with that said, it's clearly not made to be a feature-length film. Like, had they, I feel like it would have been better had they gone and they done the Killing Joke, obviously religiously to the like most of the point where they did minus the musical, and then just gone into a bunch of other Batman short stories that people have liked over the years, and just let that be the film. Because it's like, you know, obviously I'll go, and I said this before on the show, that there's so many great Batman stories that they could have recreated on the animated medium, and they could have released that, and that would have been probably better. But I was like, okay, if you're going to go with the Killing Joke, I understand where you're coming from, sort of like a business point of view. It's a storyline that's very – it's held in high regard. Okay, fine. I'll take that at face value. I'm sure there's a bunch of great short stories over the years that all the other people that have written Batman over the years that you could have done and maybe made it like a compilation. Something similar to what I think they released a couple years back calling I think it was Batman the Dark Knight. Something like that where they had a bunch of short stories about Batman. It's like, you could have just done something like that. That would have been more preferred than what we wound up getting in this. It's like, okay, let's do this 30-minute featurette from a comic book writer, but a story that no one's really heard of before. And let's do things purposely with the idea of shock value. In fact, it's funny you brought up these two films specifically on this week's show, Dazza, because these are the two movies that sort of ruined the rated R appeal. Because you had Deadpool, who went out there, had a rated R film, and people thought this was the next thing in superhero movies. They thought, oh, okay, rated R is the way to go, because this was clearly a success. After this, we saw that Batman vs. Superman was getting a rated R release, and then the Killing Joke was getting a rated R release. So that looked like it was going to be the next fad. And it's funny that I should say fad, because these films sort of underperformed. I mean, I can't speak for sit here and rip on the Ultimate Edition of Batman vs. Superman, because I haven't seen it yet. But as far as I know, that was rated R, and I know you think of highly of it, and I've yet to watch it yet, Dazza, so I can't really say one way or another. But Killing Joke was rated R, and that didn't do any favors for the film. So I'm like, okay, that sort of went by the wayside. But I'm just, it's like, okay, that fad thing. I always knew from the get go. It's like, well, if you read most comic books, they're not rated R. Like, they'll be PG-13, and if they're rated R, they'll have some big label, or they'll let you know some way, shape, or form that's clearly not a comic book that's like the rest. I mean, I think Marvel has their I forget what it's called. What's their extreme brand called, Dazza? I forget what it's called.
Max.
Max. There we go. Their Marvel Max brand. And then I even recently picked up, I think it was Miracle Man 15. And on the front cover, they specifically show you, and even the issue where Miracle Man's wife gives birth, they specifically have the warning there showing you this is not your average comic book material. This is something a little bit more. So the idea that most comic books, or at least some of them, are the really good ones, are rated R, it's like, no, that's not necessarily the fact. So you're going to go out there and do rated R. I don't know, Dazza, what do you think of the rated R fad that's, as far as I've seen, it's sort of come and gone? Because did they have a rated R release of Suicide Squad?
No, they didn't. I mean, the thing is, it's one of these things that you need. Actually, you mentioned the rated R, and something that was interesting, even though they went with the rating R of Killing Joke, they still sort of toned down the actual story from the comic. Mm. Because the scenes where sort of Commissioner Gordon sees all the photographs, and in the comic you basically see the pictures of her naked with the bullet wound and everything and stuff, and they actually sort of like, you know, glossed over that. So they wanted the R rating, but they basically still wanted to tone down the comic. But I think it's best. It's Deadpool worked because it was sort of different, and because you really need the rating R to basically go with the over the top violence and the sort of and the swearing and the humor and the sex and everything. You know, they wanted to do a no holds barred thing. I don't think necessarily going at a rated R is basically the way to go for all superheroes. I think it's sort of, if you ever did, and I realize we're not going to do this now because it's on the TV show, but if you ever did like, you know, another Punisher movie, that would have to be rated R. I think Logan is going to be rated R, which is basically sort of, but that fits into sort of, you know, the downbeat tone of what we're going to do with that movie. You know, so that really sort of, you know, does make sense. So a character like Wolverine, or a character like you know, like the Punisher, like, you know, Deadpool. If you were ever to do like a Deathstroke movie, you know, something like that. You know, they will benefit from basically sort of not watering down the character and going all out and doing an R rated. But I don't necessarily think that sort of, you know, a rated R rating is basically, you know, that's not going to solve, say, like, you know, the problems that DC have at the moment with getting people to sort of, you know, to enjoy their films. It's not, you know, it's basically got to be the right character and the, you know, and the right movie for it. You know, there will be no reason, for example, to do a, you know, an Avengers R rated cut. But there's just no point. It just wouldn't fit in. You'd just be putting in a load of stuff in there for the sake of giving it an R rating, you know.
But yeah, that's another thing I was quick to point out, that these two movies specifically followed the success of Deadpool, and I noticed that rated R sort of been something that people have sort of backed off on. Obviously, we never saw a rated R cut of Suicide Squad. It was a fad that I felt came and went. I think it was more so as Deadpool was going to be really successful and really popular regardless. They didn't need the rated R rating, so the idea that it went in there and had it, it's like, okay, that wasn't the key to the film's success. I mean, I know that's what you want to think of it is. I'm not specifically referring to you, Daz. I'm preferring just the people in general. It's like, I still feel like the character before the film was still really popular, and the film, I think, would have done just as good had it not had a rated R rating. But that is just my opinion. But like I mentioned earlier, we're going back to the Batman films. I feel like there was a bunch of other Batman stories they could have told that probably would have been more suited for the big screen. Are there any Batman stories that you're particularly fond of, Dazza? That you felt would have been better suited on the, I wouldn't say big screen, but really we're talking about the small screen. We're talking about animated DVD here. Even though I know it got a wide release. But I'm curious what you think would be a better Batman story, if you know any.
I mean, most of my favorites have actually sort of been made into you know, because I really like the Year One. I really like the Long Halloween. You know, they were two of my favorites.
Long Halloween's not been made into a film. In fact, that's the one I was going to cite. It's like, that'd be the one I probably would want a movie to be based off of.
Is he not?
Nope. There was
I thought they didn't actually call it the Long Halloween, but I thought there'd been
no other.
Maybe this is one I've really sort of imagined. I thought I'd actually seen one which was the Long Halloween, but not in name, but actually sort of, you know, the actual story of it.
No. I can't think of it. Maybe if you maybe not now, but if you can find out later what it is. But as far as I know, they haven't done a rendition of that, and that's the one I really wish they would do, because I haven't read every single Batman story. I haven't read all the classics. I read a majority of them. And the one that's my favorite, and Dave, who used to host Comic Conversation with me, I know that's his favorite Batman story. So that would be a great interpretation. But I understand that why that hasn't been made into an animated film, because it really doesn't suit itself to, you know, the big action sequences, the big especially on the big screen where, you know, there's a bunch of punching. It's very much a murder mystery. It's very much, you know, it's Batman trying to solve this murder, these murders. But I the only thing I think they've had as far as the Long Halloween is,
I think I might be thinking of Hush. I think I might be getting my
even that I don't think they've done. I can't think of anything since where they've done Hush. I mean, no, you're batting 1,000, Nazo.
Yeah, I'm not doing well tonight.
But yeah, the only thing I can think of is it's. There was this episode of the animated series where they were all telling stories, and there was one Poison Ivy one where she called it the Long Halloween, which is a bit of a nod to the Long Halloween story, but it had nothing to do with the Long Halloween storyline.
Yeah.
But okay, well, that answers my question, though. I asked you what you think would be a great adaptation for a Batman film, and you probably you agree with me, apparently, in a roundabout way. You wound up agreeing with me that Long Halloween would have been a great animated film to do.
Yeah, and Hush, you know, Hush definitely.
I'm trying to be nice here, Taz. I'm trying not to bring up your failures, but well,
yeah.
Well, let's see. Hopefully, you're right about Batman vs. Superman. That way, you're not completely striking out completely today. I think that's going to do it as far as the regular portion of the show. Unless there's very anything you want to talk about before we move on to Rate and Slate, Dazzle.
No, let's move on to Rate and Slate.
Let's move on to something that I'm sure we can get people in general to agree on. Rate and Slate for the year 2006. The list we pulled up from TKO170.com, their top 10 box office recipients. Let's go at number 10, Superman Returns. Number 9, Mission Impossible 3. Number 8, X-Men The Last Stand. Number 7, 300. Number 6, Cars. Number 5, Night at the Museum. Number 4, Casino Royale. Number 3, Ice Age The Meltdown. Number 2, The Da Vinci Code. And at number 1, according to TKO170.com's box office receipts, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest was the top film of 2006. Dazza, what is going to be your rate? I know Slate's going to be easy this week, but, you know, right?
What do you think? I might surprise you.
I think there's a couple of candidates you can go in a certain direction, but there's not a ton. You can probably, I predict you're probably going to go in one or two directions.
The one I'm going to go for, the rate, is Casino Royale.
Yes!
I think, aside from the fact that this one really took James Bond into the modern era, and this was another one of these situations where when they first announced Daniel Craig as James Bond, people basically sort of like, a lot of people rolled their eyes and thought, what the hell? I think one of the things, and particularly in the UK, I don't know how it was in America, because obviously in the UK, you know, he's basically like, you know, a British institution and everything. How they unveiled him is they had him arrive on the Thames on a speedboat, and he got off the speedboat, and he had this, his hair was basically this long blonde mop. As all can sort of describe him, he looked really, really weird. And he just looked sort of so unlike James Bond. It was just like, you know, this is not going to work. And of course, when you actually see, you know, you wait to see the film, he's basically sort of got shaved down and everything. And it was just an absolutely incredible James Bond movie, because it was so, and it, what it did is it basically took it down to it sort of like to it, like a real down and dirty roots, you know. It was sort of, you know, he still had sort of a gadgetry and everything, but it basically, I mean, this is, I don't know if you've ever read the actual James Bond books. Of all the James Bond books, this is one which would be the most difficult to actually make into a film, not because it's elaborate or anything, but because most of the book is set around a game of Baccarat, you know. So how can you actually sort of make a dramatic James Bond film when most of the film is actually based around a card game? But they sort of, you know, but they managed to do it. And it was just, there was just so many great things that they did for it. The fact that this was one of the few times when you actually saw Bond fall in love with his companion. Most of the time, they're sort of the companions are just sort of there, and there's some sort of affection there. But this is one where he was basically prepared to basically walk away from everything, you know, for her.
Moneypenny, no less.
Sorry?
Said Moneypenny, no less, right?
Moneypenny.
Yeah. Wasn't that who she was?
In Casino Royale, no.
I thought she was. Okay, no. Sorry. I don't know what sprouted the idea in my head. I was mistaken. I'm sorry, Daz. Continue with your review.
we're doing 2-1 now.
Well, yeah, it's fitting. I don't want you to feel out there all alone. It's like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Moneypenny shows up in Skyfall. Yeah, she's yeah, but no, this is and it's. It basically sort of takes the James Bond thing sort of back to its, like, you know, its Cold War roots sort of thing, except this time it's not the Russians. It's basically sort of, you know, the profiteers of terrorism. And it's just, you know, it's one of these things where it's sort of like a new James Bond, but he's also a very, you know, and he's sort of like one of the toughest James Bond that's come along, but he's also one of the most vulnerable. I mean, he has his heart broken in these films. He basically, you see him basically sort of tortured. And actually, something that you'd never see James Bond normally is he actually gets scared in this film. When he's captured and where he's sort of strapped naked to the chair and he's being tortured and he's trying to put a brave face on it and he's trying to, you know, and he's sort of, there's a bit where he's sort of, you know, sort of pretending to, you know, he's where he's laughing and say, you know, everyone's going to know that you've been sort of like, you know, touching my balls. And he's sort of saying this, but he's also saying this through tears because he's actually sort of in so much pain. Whereas in the previous films, you never saw Bond sort of like broken or put into a vulnerable position. And I just think it was just an amazing, you know, sort of, you know, direction that we took with the character. And overall, the film, I just absolutely loved.
Yeah, it's a really great film. I haven't seen the other Daniel Craig movies, but I have seen the other James Bond films. I haven't seen the rest of the Daniel Craig, but I've seen this one. This one's really good, and it's funny you bring up the idea that he sort of. He not only did he fall in love, but he was presumably quitting the double O agent game, and then eventually she winds up dying. My favorite part is when she dies and M calls him and he tries to completely no sell it because she's there and she's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, James. Are you gonna be okay if you need any time off? You know, I understand what she meant to you and blah blah blah." And then James Bond completely tries to no sell it and he busts out with this:
"The bitch is dead."
That's actually the last line in the novel.
Oh, it's so
good. In Casino Royale, that's actually the last line of the novel. And it does really stick, although it's sort of like, you know, the action sort of like, you know, put in there and everything, it does stick really, really close to the novel. But that opening scene, I forgot about this, the opening scene where he basically sort of ambushes the guy in the office, when he's waiting for him, where he's coming up, and he sort of tells him that he's basically killed his sort of contact and everything, and then he just basically casually just like, you know, shoots him in the head. Amazing scene. And done in black and white as well. I actually think in all the, if you were to go through all the, you know, the top 10 opening scenes to a movie, if that didn't get in the top 10, it would at least get an honorable mention. Because he's just so good. It just basically, and in that scene, it basically, any doubts that you had about him being James Bond, you know, would just wipe away because he was just sort of, you know, so great in it.
Well, I understand what that criticism are, that I think when people watch the film, their criticism, I guess whatever doubts they had been silenced, but I sort of saw where they came from because what you've seen from the trailers and what little I saw at the beginning of the movie was, you know, he's very much a brooding, sort of intimidating kind of, you know. You normally when you think of James Bond, you think of, you know, he's obviously, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go as far as looks are concerned because I'm a heterosexual male and I'm uncomfortable when I'm talking about this stuff. But he's very much, you know, he's not a debonair. He's not, you know, he's not charismatic. I mean, he certainly has his own charisma, but he's not the traditional sort of, you know, I would say like the boozy kind of, you know, debonair kind of James Bond, where this is sort of like he's a stoic, and obviously he does have his charm, and he does a couple of one-liners here, but for the most part, he's very much a very realistic, down-to-earth James Bond, where the James Bond is sort of seen as I don't even know, like I said, the only word I can think of is like debonair and sort of like swarmy to a degree, and certainly Daniel Craig wasn't that, so I understand why people had their reservations when they went into this film, because it's like, he's certainly not that. He's very stoic, he's very no-nonsense, and it's like, okay, you're gonna have that guy be the James Bond? That guy's supposed to be the charismatic dad that managed to charm his way into girls' pants? It's like, don't know.
you know who you sound like?
Who?
My mum. That's exactly what she says. And she just says, he's not suave enough to be James Bond. And any time we watch a Daniel Craig, James Bond film, that's all she says. He's not suave enough to be James Bond. But he actually is more like the James Bond of the novels. You know, to he is, you know, that is what, you know, that sort of like, you know, really rough sort of like, you know, character. That is what he's like in the novels, so...
Yeah, and I guess that's more fitting of the character, but, you know, with people, especially, I'm sure there's lots of people that, maybe not that listen to this show, because the people that listen to the show are pretty smart, but people that have seen the James Bond films over the years and even know it was based off of a book series, So the idea that there's a different kind of James Bond out there, people, when people think of James Bond, I'm sure there's several actors they think of, but the one they think of, I'm sure more than often than not, is Sean Connery. And they often compare him, and you know, fairly or unfairly, they compare him to all the other Bonds. And yeah, he is a Bond unto himself, but, with that said, certainly Daniel Craig is a great addition. If anything, I like, because like you mentioned earlier, it's more true the character how it's written in the book, but it's also the idea that you can go out there and have a wide range of James Bond with the idea of, okay, just go with the one you like with the best. But
you know why that is, don't you?
No, I do not.
It's because we're not the same James Bond. They're all different. Eh? This is my theory, which if you go on
halfbond.com.
Or if you basically Google on halfguarded.com and James Bond, because we don't have a search engine yet on Halfguarded, still, you will find my article where I espouse the theory that there's basically not one James Bond, but several, that James Bond is actually a pseudonym as such, and that basically all these different actors are actually playing different James Bonds. And it's basically, the James Bond is basically a code name adopted by several agents throughout the years.
Huh.
And I make a good case. if I say so myself.
I'll link that in the description, because I sort of, if people haven't already yet read that yet, it's pretty great.
All right. But it does work. It does work.
I mean, they certainly establish in the series that there's multiple M's. So who's to say there can't be several James Bonds, several 007s?
Exactly. And also a lot of the M's basically sort of cross over. So because Judi Dench, she basically gets Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig as a James Bond. The original M, he basically had Sean Connery, Lazenby and Roger Moore. You know, so and there are very differences. Basically, I read the article, but I feel that I make a compelling argument.
There you go. I'll be sure to link that in the description. All right. So, I feel like we're moving on, but we're really not, because we're going into my rate, and I'm certainly going to have to agree with you. Casino Royale is going to be my rate as well. Without selling 300, obviously, another honorable mention to Cars. But with that said, you know, I wouldn't say head and shoulders, because I'd say 300 is pretty close, but I think the objective person would probably go with Casino Royale. I think it's a better film. Obviously, there's things to like about 300. It's certainly not a film I would sneeze at, but it really can't compare to Casino Royale. And Cars, and the other film I mentioned earlier was Cars. And it's like that's a fun outing. That's a fun family film. That's, you know, when people nowadays, Pixar, I think, is losing a lot of steam, losing a lot of momentum. But Cars is, in fact, one of the films that they've made over the years that, in fact, have been very good. And when people think Pixar, they think of Cars. All right. We got the positivity out of the way. Let's go into the negativity, Dazzle. What's going to be your slate? And this year, you certainly have – you can certainly go in many directions, and you certainly can't be wrong.
I'm going to shock you. I'm going to go with 300.
Oh, Dazzle! Shame! Bad Dazzle! I wish I had rolled up newspapers so I could hit you on the nose with it like a dog.
I hate this movie.
Wow.
I think it looks glorious and everything, but the actual, I just hate the characters. I think it's just it basically takes macho to a complete and utter unlikable level. The characters are so unlikable, and their society is so unlikable. To this age, I have to say the battle of, and I can never pronounce this, the battle of Thermopylae or Thermopylae or however it's pronounced, I think is one of the great stories in ancient history. You know, I've read novels which were set, there's a novel by Stephen Pressfield, which I think is called Gates of Fire, which is basically just about that sort of, that battle and the fact of like 300 troops. Oops, I hold in the line so that sort of, you know, the defences can basically, you know, can be sort of prepared in the, you know, that sort of heroic sacrifice, I think is a great story. In this one, I just wanted that whole society to burn. I think the characters are absolutely obnoxious. The women are obnoxious. When the Cersei Lannister woman earlier on makes that statement about, only Spartan women know how to breed real men. I just start thinking, oh, for God's sake, get over yourself, bitch. You know, I just want, you know, and just this whole society where they basically sort of like, you know, turn them into warriors and everything, they're so sort of just so unlikable. I mean, the thing where they're sort of building the wall out of all the dead and everything, I just wanted, these were supposed to be the heroes. I know they're sort of shades of grey, but I just wanted these sort of, these macho bastards with their massive physiques and everything, and I just wanted them to basically just get slaughtered. I absolutely hate, I just hated the whole film.
Yeah. you're certainly wrong. Some of the criticisms you're right on, but I think your ultimate conclusion is 1,000% wrong. It's even on its worst day, and there, you know, certainly people have looked at the film constructively since then. But at the same time, it's like, no, it's still a good film, Daz. You're sort of, you know, you're out to you're out to lunch here, because I'm looking at the other films you could have gone with. Now, obviously, I know you want to make a statement, but to sit there and tell me with a straight face that somehow in way, shape, or form, that 300 is worse than The Da Vinci Code? It was worse than X-Men The Last Stand? Is worse than Pirates of the Caribbean Dead Man's Chest? Come on, Dazza. Work with
I'm
me
not saying,
here.
Yeah, but we're not talking about what we think is the worst necessarily. We're just picking one that we personally hate ourselves. Well, there are many films that I sort of... I like better than better films of quality. You know, it's just a case of how it comes down to how you like. And just in the same way, there are many films that I hate more than other films, even though I recognize that it is a stunning film, a really sort of, you know, well made film in many ways. And for what it's trying to do, I just don't like that sort of depiction of characters. You know, the movie I just absolutely hated. I also really hated that the whole thing with the, I mean, women get a real sort of bad deal in this film, but I really hated the scenes where they were sacrificing the women to the, to those, prophets, where they would basically sort of take a young girl up there to be sort of like basically pretty much raped and molested just so they could get like a prediction on the battle from them. Which was pretty much what it was. I just found the whole, it was one of those films as I'm watching, I was just found it, just felt it like a really grubby, horrible experience. So yeah, this wasn't one that I particularly like. I tell you, so I absolutely, and again, I'm really alone in this. I really love that film, the Spartans one. I forgot what the exact title of it. Basically, it was a spoof of 300. Now, most of these movie spoof films, I absolutely I don't have any time for it. I think they're really lazy. But this one, it just if ever was a film that needed to be parodied, 300 was it. And basically, you know, and I absolutely, do you know the film I'm talking about?
No, I'm not.
I think it's Meet the Spartans.
Oh, that's what you're referring to. I thought you were talking about something else. But
yeah. No, Meet the Spartans. I absolutely thought that film was hilarious, basically because of my prejudice against this movie. But if ever a movie wanted to be spoofed, it was 300. And I thought they did it great by sort of really ramping up the homoeroticism and stuff. And a lot of people hate that film. They just think it's not funny at all. I thought it was hilarious, especially with a bit of a start where they're basically sort of they're teaching the kid to fight. And then they sort of keep upping the ante. So 1 minute they're like hitting him. Next minute they're hitting him with chairs and then chasing him with chainsaws and firing like paint bullets at him and things. I just think it's a hilarious film.
All right. Let's see. My top 10, I'm certainly going to have to go that hard to try to pick one out the bunch. Obviously, I mentioned all the other ones I wanted to compare your pick to, Daz. But the one I'm going to have to go with, the biggest disappointment, and maybe this is sort of similar to something what you said earlier. It's not necessarily the worst film, but it's the one we feel like putting a spotlight on. But I'm going to have to go with Superman Returns. This film was an abysmal waste of time. I hated this film. It was so boring. It was so, like, I can't even think of the word I'm thinking of. It just seems so lackluster. It seems so boring. Like, the idea that you're going to go out there and have a film, a Bat Superman film, that's supposed to be a sequel to the the Superman films as of yet, and it's like it's going to go out there and just be boring. It's like you're going to go out there and tell a really bad interpretation of a Superman story. It's like, okay, this film isn't not only this film not for me, it's not for anybody. I can't imagine anyone liking this film. Obviously, in the years that come, there have been people that have been sort of a little bit more apologetic about it, being like, oh, it's not so bad. No one's come out and say it's not that bad. Even Daz, I don't think you'll defend this film.
No, not at all. Not at all. I remember sort of really being excited about the prospect of another Superman film. And this came about at a time when I was sort of, I was always going to movies, but I wasn't really paying much attention to sort of reading or about them much. So I wasn't like reading reviews for a lot of movies. And this, so I went into this and the original Superman music comes out and I'm really pumped for it. And the film itself was just, like I say, it's bland. And also the, the Clark Kent character, they basically, I think they obviously made a mistake on trying to tie this in with the Christopher Reeve universe, you know, because, you know, the Lois Lane of this era wasn't, just, you know, shouldn't have the sort of, they didn't have the sort of charisma or the, what's the word? The chemistry, you know, the chemistry, which was such a, you know, a big part of the other movies, and it just wasn't really good at all. The only person in this film who I actually liked was not Lex Luthor. I thought Kevin Spacey was really disappointing in this film as well. Is Kevin Spacey's he's sort of, you know, the woman he had with him.
Oh, Parker Posey. I don't know the name of her character, but Parker Posey in that film.
Yeah, I thought she was hilarious in it. You know, she was only like a really, really small part of it. But just the whole thing, the whole plot and everything, it was just like a really, like you say, a really sort of dire, you know, a dire movie. And the whole thing with sort of bringing in like, you know, a Superman's son and everything like that. Yeah, I don't think it was very good at all.
Daz, as a pro wrestling fan, you'll appreciate her name, Kitty Kowalski.
Ah.
For those of you who are pro wrestling fans and don't get the reference, there's an old, I guess you people say highly, people think of highly of the pro wrestling, mainly because he was a great pro wrestling trainer, but in and of his day, he was pretty great too. Killer Kowalski.
Yeah.
That's cute. Oh god, and I'm looking at the cast here, and they had the nerve to cast Marlon Brando in this film. Obviously they show the scenes where he goes back to the Fortress of Solitude, and they show him where he's looking at the old image, the old for lack of a better term, video of the Jor-El, what he say for Superman from the other films. But they're like, oh, let's cross this over and let's make it apply to the current Superman films as well. It's like, oh god, just like, please stop. I very rarely am I in favor of reboots, but this is one time they probably should have gone with the reboot, because the idea that most of the cast, especially when you're talking Christopher Reeves, has since moved. I don't know if he had passed on at this point, but the cast of these films has certainly moved on. And it's like, oh, okay, you're going to go out there and try to do a sequel based off the stuff you did so far. And usually I'm one to condemn films for doing that, because I'm just like, okay, just deal with the comic books. Obviously, they don't have the same artist and writer doing the same films, but you're still telling the same story built on the stuff that you've done before. It's like, okay, just do something off that. But this is, there'd been such a layoff that they really should have just done a reboot. And obviously, they did do a reboot, and maybe that wasn't the silver bullet either. But, all right, that is going to be my slate for 2006. Let's look at the rest of this list from TKO 170. Other notables. The Departed. That's a fantastic film. I'm surprised.
That's a great film.
I'm surprised that wasn't higher on the list. Borat, I thought it was a really great, funny film. I'm a big fan of Sacha Baron Cohen. Rocky Balboa, that film's phenomenal. Daz, have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. I mean, that one is just absolutely phenomenal.
Other films on this list as well. Dreamgirls, that was a good, great film. Talladega Nights, the Ballad of Ricky Bobby. That's another great comedy film on that list. Yeah, this is a bad year for films. I'm pointing out all all the winners here, at least as far as the good movies are concerned. But you know, this is a list of 50 films, and I'd say about 25 of these are duds. Well, with the exception of
Miami Vice was awful.
I'm sure Dazzle will like this film, Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift.
Now, this is before they got good.
Okay. Oh, before they got. I'm sorry, Dazza. I'm sorry. You're right. Before they got good.
Miami Vice was awful. Miami Vice was one of the a kind of a thing with films that if I managed to like watch the first hour, I've sort of like see it through, and with Miami Vice, I just gave up. It is just a Vice is a slow moving plot that just seems to go nowhere. It's just absolutely awful, really awful movie. And one of the things that about that film is you took what's his face, the main actor in it.
Let me pull up the cast of this. Oh, it's I'm looking at his face, but it's been so long that he's actually done anything relevant. I'm like, God, what's his name? The Irishman. I forget his name. God, it's so sad that I don't even know his name. Colin Farrell, there we go.
Colin, yeah. You cannot tell what he is saying at all in that film. You can't. It's just everywhere. It's just like this growling grumble that he does. Or you just hear him too go, cocaine shipment, Medivas, on the pier. It's just like that the whole time. You're sort of thinking, what is he saying?
You certainly can't get an argument from me.
If that does not show up on the Razzies when we get to them, that's something's wrong there.
Yeah, Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx. Wow. I mean, Jamie Foxx certainly, maybe he could redeem this film, but the idea that you're putting the two of them together with the idea they're going to have any kind of chemistry, it's like, oil and water there. It's like, maybe to get separately, I think you mentioned earlier the Colin Farrell thing, but they could have worked had they paired them up with people that have been who better accentuated their strengths. But man, you're gonna pair those two together.
I suppose you sort of give him props for the fact that they actually tried to play it straight. Because a lot of times when we sort of take films from the 80s and 70s nowadays, they tend to try to make them into spoofs. You know, like they did it with Skarsky & Hutch, we're doing it with Chips. The 21 Jump Street, they sort of make them into sort of comedies, which are kind of like sort of, you know, making fun of the original movie and everything. So at least they did try to make it straight, but it didn't. In fact, to be honest, it was probably after this that we actually started making them all spoofs. They probably sort of figured out, well, we can't make these films any good anymore. So
there you go. Before we move on, I want to mention another film, Little Miss Sunshine. I thought this film had done a lot better, but I guess it was such a sleeper hit that it just barely made its way onto the TKO 170 top 50 list at number 47.
Yeah, that's a cute film.
Yeah, that was certainly a film that no one saw coming. It was this great, fantastic film. I'm certainly, when we go into the Oscars later, it certainly made its presence felt. But this film was most memorable because it brought back Greg Kinnear back from obscurity. It's like up until now, it's like he had all but disappeared, and this was sort of his coming back party, as it were, his comeback. Because up until now, it's like I had not heard from Greg Kinnear in forever.
I did not know they'd done an Omen remake.
You're going to wish you hadn't, won't you?
Am I? Yeah.
I think they made it 1,000% because of the date that the film came out. Are you aware with the date?
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, it came out June 6, 2016. And I don't need to do the math for you to figure out why they decided to release this film in June 6, 2016. Or 2006. I'm sorry. I'm so used to the modern day, but even now it's 2016. All right, that's gonna do it for the TKO 170 list. Dazza, of all the films that we mentioned earlier, the ones that we put in, above head and shoulders above the films, what do you think won Best Picture in 2007? Obviously, they do it the year after. So, what do you think won 2007's best Picture winner?
I'm going to go. God, this is a tough one. I know Departed got nominated, but I don't think it won. I'm going to go with... I'm going to go with The Pursuit of Happiness.
Wrong! Speaking of Superman Returns, that had to be worth something, right? There had to be something redeeming about that film. At least we got a meme out of it. No, Dazza, you would be incorrect. Let's see if it was even nominated. It would not shock me if it wasn't even nominated. Let's see the award nominees. Best Picture nominees were Babel, Iwo Jima. There we go. Sorry, I read that wrong. Little Miss Sunshine, The Queen, and what ultimately won, The Departed.
All right, okay.
Well, I will say this.
So I was on the right track originally, but I talked myself out of winning.
Exactly. Well, actually, you were sort of right, too. They thought enough of Will Smith's performance to nominate him for Best Actor, but also with that, he didn't win. So there's that as well. But at least you were, like you said, you talked yourself out of it.
Yeah.
All right.
I almost got stuck in the place where that's Pursuit of Happiness, where that's filmed. I almost got, I did actually get stuck right in the middle of there when I went to San Francisco. It was not a nice area.
All right. Let's try to find the 27th annual Golden Razzies. Dazza, you know the gimmick. I list off the worst pictures and you try to guess what won worst picture. All right. From Romar Entertainment, which should give you a bit of a cue of whether or not it won. But Blood Rain, Lady in the Water from Warner Brothers Pictures, Little Man, The Wicker Man, and Basic Instinct 2.
I'm going to go with Basic Instinct 2.
You would be correct, Dazza. Even a broken clock, right? I'm sorry.
The reason why I'm saying that is, if I remember correctly, Sharon Stone actually went and collected her reward.
Let's see. I believe she won. Yes, she won a worst actress. Yes,
I think there's only two people who've done that. One was Sandra Bullock, and one was Sharon Stone.
I wonder
which why. I have to say, I admire him for that, for actually having a laugh with it.
Because there's the thing I wonder: did they know it was bad? And here's the thing: you have to make a living in Hollywood, so you're going out there and acknowledging, yeah, this was a bad film, or are you acknowledging that your performance was bad? Because you know, if I didn't agree with the director at all, or at least the studio, the way they decided to go with the film, I'd certainly be more than happy to be like, yeah. My performance was great. This film's terrible. I'm going to collect the Razzie, be a good sport about it, but I don't know. You mentioned worst actress. When I mentioned worst actor, Marlon and Sean Wayans and Little Man. I certainly would have thought when it comes to worst picture, I would have gone with Little Man, but that is the film where the I forgot which Wayne, but I'm sure I think it was Marlon was the small gangster who was masquerading as a baby. And it's like, oh,
I've got to admit, I don't know this film.
You're better off, Dazza. I'm not kidding. This is not me being hyperbolic. It's like, no, it's really a bad film. I really don't recommend that. You're not even taking the trailer, because then you'll probably wind up hating yourself. But worst supporting actor, M. Night Shyamalan in Lady of the Water. Let's see other ones that are notable. I haven't seen this category pop up in a while, but worst prequel or sequel. Obviously, Basic Instinct won, but other notables were Big Mama's House 2, Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties, The Santa Claus 3, The Escape Clause, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning.
Oh, my God. They made the Santa Claus 3?
Yeah. You know, Tim, Tim Allen needed money, yo.
They made a Garfield 2. They made a Big Mama's House too.
I just like hearing you say Big Mama.
What? Why the hell do they do this?
Something about Englishman saying Big Mama. It's hysterical.
Big Mummy. That's that. Big Mummy's House.
And my favorite category is worst excuse for family entertainment, RV. I vaguely remember this film. It was the Robin Williams and Cheryl Hines. God, who would thought they'd make a great pairing for this film? maybe Robin Williams is onto something. Oh, too soon, Dazza?
Maybe.
Okay.
I just look at the worst excuse for family entertainment. Funnily enough, I started watching Deck the Halls this Christmas one time, and I didn't last very long.
For those of you who thought a fun comedic pairing would be Danny DeVito, obviously, you know, I'll agree there. He's a pretty funny guy. If you put him, you know, paired him up with the right person, he may make for some great entertainment. But when you thought the idea would be a great pairing would be with him and Matthew Broderick, I don't care how bad the script is, that film's going to be bad no matter what.
When was the last time Matthew Broderick did something? Something good.
I'm certainly not a fan, but I'm sure most people would probably disagree with me. But the producers, the film version, the film adaptation of it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that film?
You know what? I don't think I ever have. I've seen the original.
Oh, then you're best off then, because. I don't know. Matthew Broderick and, God, what's the name of the other gentleman? I forget now. Well, it's not important. I'm looking at the latest film he's been up to. Got a bunch of films I've never heard of. Ooh!
I'm just going through by.
He's done actually. He's done some stuff that I would actually kind of like. He's been in episodes of Adventure Time. He was a voice in that. He was in the Jim Gaffigan show, which I'm sure was ill-fated. Louie. Great TV show. I'm noticing a lot of television, a lot of one-offs. But he was in Trainwreck. Ask Matthew Broderick. I think he's been more low-key. I think certainly he's made his money being film after film after film. I think now he's... I mean, I'm sure he did Godzilla for a reason. Certainly because it couldn't have been... He thought it was a great film.
But he's done some right rubbish. I'm just going through the list now. He really sort of hit the ground running when he did Ferris Bueller's Day Off and War Games, and you know even Project X. I really enjoyed that. I thought Glory was great, and then after that he just kind of sort of really, from Cable Guy onwards, he just. Everything's just complete drivel.
There was
a Lion King 2?
Yes, unfortunately. It's in the pantheon of direct to DVD Lion King films, Dazza. Or not Lion King films, Disney films. I don't know if you know this, Dazza, but Disney has this thing of they'll do a direct to video sequel to most of their films, and generally it's frowned upon. They're just seen as 100% a money grab, and more often than not they're not good. I mean there's a couple exceptions, but for the most part they all tend to be pretty terrible. And for those of you who are wondering what the other name was of, I'm sure the film aficionados were probably screaming at me for not mentioning Nathan Lane and the producers. But I'll say this: pairing Nathan Lane with Matthew Broderick, that's another pairing. It's like, oh god, really?
Okay, so they did The Lion King 2 in 1998. Then in 2004, they did The Lion King 1.5. What is that? Oh, it's a computer game.
No. It was actually a full-length direct-to-DVD release. It was a film that took place. It primarily focused on Timon and Pumbaa and Simba. It took place between. It's funny they call it 1.5, but it really didn't take place between the two films. It was pretty much all the journeys that Timon and Pumbaa and Simba had gone on as Simba was growing up.
Do
you remember anything of Lion King?
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
So obviously you remember there was they did obviously with the montage, but there was obviously a period in time where he was growing up with Timon and Pumbaa, and that's what the Lion King 1.5 is supposed to be.
Yeah. I remember watching The Lion King, and when they came away, I thought, yeah, you know what? I would really love to see a spin-off to see what was actually happening with the warthog and the meerkat and the little baby Simba.
Daz, are you being sarcastic? You wouldn't happen to be sarcastic, would you?
I'm being sarcastic, yes.
All right. That's going to do it for the that portion of the show. Since we're talking all things films already, and we're slowly starting to wrap this show up, Daz, have there been any films you've been watching as of late you feel like talking about?
I went to the cinema to see Trainspotting 2, which I spoke about a couple of weeks ago as one of my sort of anticipated movies for the year. And I it's a very different film from the first one. It's, you know, in tone and everything, but I really, really enjoyed it. I think one of the things I liked about this film, I think this is a film that sort of is going to do well with people of my age, particularly, you know, ones who saw Trainspotting when it came out, because it basically, it comes back to the lives of these characters in the exact same amount of time that it's taken to make the film. So you're basically sort of some 20 years on. So it kind of works for me, because I sort of, it brought me back to where I was at that time. And it sort of, because I was about the age of most of the characters in that film. And so it was sort of like really, really funny to actually sort of see myself now as the same age as those characters that I'd left all of those years ago in Trainspotting. It's a lot more sort of, it's a lot more light-hearted, even though the first one was, had a lot of sort of comedy in it. It was still a very sort of dark and gritty film. This has a lot more light-hearted feel to it as a movie, but it was still sort of, it still had a sort of like it had a real edge to it, and it was just sort of, it was just great to sort of get back to, you know, to those four characters. And it was just sort of like, you know, a really, really enjoyable romp. It had a lot of the sort of, you know, the great humor, and them still sort of, you know, trying to get by in life. Obviously, they're not sort of doing, well, one of them still doing the heroin and everything. But it was for me a really sort of, you know, a nice nostalgic look back, you know, on these characters and see where they are and everything. And so there was a lot of fun to be had in there as well, you know. But yeah, this was one I if you saw the first one, I think it's sort of almost like a must see, personally.
Okay.
The other film that I saw, and I've basically never seen this film before. I watched it on Netflix. Invasion USA.
Oh, God.
Starring Chuck Norris. My one regret watching this film is that I didn't do an audio commentary while watching this film for the first time. It was just amazing. It was just so... I love my B-movies and everything and sort of thing. And this was the epitome of a great B-movie. Chuck Norris was just awesome in this for all the wrong reasons. It was just such. It was basically the perfect B movie character. It was just sort of had absolutely. It was just hysterical how this one character was basically nothing. It was just nothing fazed him at all. He just didn't seem to give a shit about anything. You know, any time it was basically the sort of the epitome of, in wrestling terms, no selling everything. You know, America's been invaded by terrorists. And for some reason, these terrorists who invaded America, you don't know who they are or why they're actually doing this or what their agenda is. We just seem to be a bunch of guys who basically just want to fuck America up. That seems to be it. There's no real sense of what country they come from or what sort of religion or what their agenda is. They're just there. They just basically sort of storm the beach, invade America, and start blowing up suburbia. That's the first target. You know, the first target isn't to actually seize the radio stations or, you know, the bases or the radio community, anything like that you normally get in a sort of any siege or invasion of any time. First thing they do is invade the country, go to a like suburb and blow all the houses up. It was just so over the top. But there's so many scenes in this film as well where Whoever, I didn't look up who the director was or anything, but whoever he was, he had a real sort of knack of wanting basically scenes to basically play out with lots of suspense. But what you got instead was basically lots of scenes where you just like watched a guy for like about like half a minute, like walking down a corridor, and then something, or another guy would basically be reading a newspaper. And then all of a sudden the door would blow off and the sort of invasion had happened. It's just the amount of times where you have these long scenes of sort of silence, which were meant to be build, but were basically just like nothing actually happening. It was just so, I wish I could have watched this with somebody so I could have just commented on this film, because there were just so many funny moments in there. You know, Chuck Norris, when he's basically, I mean, It's like kind of like a cliche where you sort of get like a hero, an anti-hero with his gun pointing at some guy on the ground, some like villain who is meant to catch. And so rather than taking prisoner, he just like shoots him in the head with one like bullet and then walks off. In this one, he didn't shoot the guy with like one bullet. He basically sort of let the guy have it with two Uzis at the same time. Just sort of ripped into him with a hail of bullets from his Uzis. This was a kind of sort of macho I enjoyed, because it was just so over the top and fun. And almost, you know, it was just like, you know, just a circle. But Chuck Norris was like a complete badass in this one. There's a scene where he's basically helping to sort of like capture an alligator for no apparent reason, apart from the fact that it just makes Chuck Norris look awesome. You know, this was a kind of sort of, B movie that I love. Just like over the top, lots of fun and totally ridiculous. And what I love as well is the film ends where he just kills the bad guy. And that's it. He just like shoots the bad guy. And then the film basically just ends right there and the credits roll. No sort of like aftermath, or nothing like where the Rock in San Andreas, when he basically sort of does the speech of now we rebuild or anything. You know, he just shoots the bad guy. That's it. The end. I love it.
That's wacky. Well, where else does it need to go, Dazza? What do you expect? All right, Dazza, I think that's going to do it for this week's show, unless there's anything else you very quickly want to talk about.
No, I'm done.
I'm done, Gus.
I'm done, Gus.
Oh, that's... I need to find that later. That needs to be our outro. I'm done, Gus. The Kimbo Slice drop of just him saying that. But that'll be in episodes to come. That's how you know when the show's over. All right, that's going to do it from all of us at halfguard.com. Thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, talk to you guys next week. Adios.